May the words of my mouth and the thoughts of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, our Lord, our Rock and our Redeemer. Amen. Yesterday was Waitangi Day. The signing of the Treaty of Waitangi was quite an important event in the history of New Zealand. And today there's a certain pride if you can say that one of your ancestors was present on that occasion. Or at least if you can say that one of your ancestors knew someone who was there quite well. I understand that one of your former vicars, Mandy Neal, does indeed have ancestors closely associated with those events. I can't say that, but my ancestors were nevertheless connected to some of the people involved during those days in February 1840. They knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who knew someone who was not only there, but had a crucial role to play. So sit back, and I want to tell you that story today. Because too often we think of that meeting at Waitangi as only the meeting between the English and Maori. But it took place within a greater international context, a context in which God was at work. To make that connection, I have to trace histories across the continents. Indeed, we will travel through all five continents, except Antarctica, that is. And I will begin the story in a continent I have actually never visited personally, in Africa. In 1827, in Luanda, in modern-day Angola, a girl was born to an African couple. The mother was a Catholic Christian, probably through Portuguese missionaries who had been there for some time. The parents called the little girl Gebe. When she was 5 years old, Gebe went to the beach with two of her cousins. A boat arrived on the beach from a ship anchored off the coast. The sailors offered sweets to the girls. They then grabbed the girls and dragged them to the boat. One of Gebe's cousins was able to escape, but the other two girls were brought to the Portuguese slave ship Herina. Gebe and her cousin were the last human cargo acquired before the slave traders decided they had a sufficient load. And so the ship set off for Cuba. At that time, slave trading was already illegal according to British law. The slave traders, in this case, evaded British patrols. But the ship got into a storm near the southern coast of Jamaica. It ran aground on rocks and was shipwrecked. Many of the crew and slaves perished. Gebe and her cousin made it safely to shore. While the surviving captain and crew were arrested and jailed, the surviving captives were set free. Gebe and her cousin were adopted by the governor of Jamaica, the Earl of Mulgrave. And so she now received the name Catherine Mulgrave. The girls were homeschooled by Maria Lady Mulgrave, a devout Christian. In 1834, the Earl and Lady Mulgrave left Jamaica to take up a new post as the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland. On medical advice, Catherine and her adopted sister were left in Jamaica. But the adoptive parents continued to send correspondence and money to Catherine for a long time to come. From then on, Catherine stayed in the Moravian Mission in Fairfield, Jamaica. The Moravians, by the way, are one of the oldest Brethren denominations. They were established even before the Protestant Reformation and are of Bohemian origin. Bohemia is the region which is now in the Czech Republic, and back then was mainly German-speaking. Now, we'll just leave Catherine to the side for a little bit, and I want to follow the story of Catherine's adoptive parents. The Earl of Mulgrave, Constantine Henry Phipps, was now known as Lord Normanby. About his governance of Ireland, we'll just say that there was no major incident. However, he did not address the underlying structural issues that were to lead to the Great Famine a decade later. Still, the issues around Ireland were politically and socially complex and led to the downfall of several British governments in the 1840s. So maybe we can't blame one official for not undertaking all the required difficult reforms. In 1839, Lord Normanby became the colonial secretary. It was under his term in office that the British government decided to enter into a treaty with Maori. Lord Normanby oversaw this undertaking. With the help of James Stephen, an important member of the Clapham sect, Lord Normanby wrote a letter of instructions to Captain William Hobson, setting out the background and the terms of the treaty. Now, I'll read a few excerpts from the letter just to give you an idea of the things that Lord Normanby and James Stephen had in mind when they came here. So they said, "We have not been unaware of the great natural resources of New Zealand, or that its geographical position must enable it to exercise a paramount influence in that quarter of the globe. On the other hand, the increase in national wealth and power promised by the acquisition of New Zealand would be most inadequate compensation for the injury which must be inflicted on this kingdom itself by embarking on a measure is essentially unjust and but too certainly fraught with calamity to a numerous and inoffensive people whose title to the soil and to the sovereignty to New Zealand is indisputable and has been solemnly recognized by the British government. The necessity for the interposition of government has, however, become too evident to admit to any further inaction. British subjects have become permanent inhabitants of New Zealand. These people, unrestrained by any law and amenable to no tribunals, were alternately the authors and victims of every species of crime and outrage. It further appears that extensive cessions of land have been obtained from the natives, and that several hundred persons have recently sailed from this country to occupy and cultivate these lands. The spirit of adventure has thus been effectually roused. It can no longer be doubted that an extensive settlement of British subjects will be rapidly established in New Zealand, and that unless protected and restrained by necessary laws and institutions, they will repeat unchecked in that corner of the globe the same process of war and spoliation under which uncivilized tribes have almost invariably disappeared as often as they have been brought into the immediate vicinity of emigrants from the nations of Christendom. To mitigate and, if possible, avert these disasters and to rescue the emigrants themselves from the evils of a lawless state of society, it has been resolved to adopt the most effective measures for establishing amongst them a settled form of civil government. To accomplish this design is the principal object of your mission. Believing that the welfare of the natives would, under the circumstances I have mentioned, be best promoted by the surrender to Her Majesty of a right of independence, now so precarious and little more than nominal, and persuaded that the benefits of British protection and laws administered by British judges would far more than compensate for the sacrifice by the natives of that national independence, Her Majesty's government has resolved to authorize you to treat with the Aborigines of New Zealand in the recognition of Her Majesty's sovereign authority over the whole or any part of those islands. All dealings with the natives for their lands must be conducted on the same principles of sincerity, justice, and good faith as must govern your transactions with them for the recognition of Her Majesty's sovereignty. Nor is that all. They must not be permitted to enter into any contracts in which they might be ignorant and unintentional authors of injuries to themselves. You will not, for example, purchase from them any territory, the retention of which by them would be essential or highly conducive to their own comfort, safety, or subsistence. There are yet other duties owing to the natives of New Zealand, which may be all comprised in the comprehensive expression of promoting their civilization, understanding by that term whatever relates to religious, intellectual, and social advancement of humankind. For the religious instruction, liberal provision has already been made by the seal of the missionaries and the missionary societies in this kingdom, and it will be at once the most important and the most grateful of your duties to afford the utmost encouragement, protection, and support to Christian teachers. I acknowledge also the obligation of rendering to the missions such pecuniary aid as the local government may be able to afford. Until they can be brought within the pale of civilized life and trained to the adoption of its habits, the natives must be carefully defended in the observance of their own customs, so far as these are compatible with the universal maxims of humanity and morals. Well, the letter goes on to describe the government in detail, and I won't go into it. I've quoted for long enough. Now, the letter may be somewhat paternalistic in tone, but the overall intention of a society of respect and justice can easily be discerned. Unfortunately, some of the fears of Lord Normanby were later realized, and the powers of greed, injustice, and folly marred the vision of that peaceful country those people had. Sometimes I wonder to what extent Lord Normanby's views were influenced by having an adopted daughter who was saved from the fate of slavery. The Treaty and New Zealand have this heritage of Christian faithfulness that looks for the good of all people, that seeks to bring God's kingdom to this world. Well, Lord Normanby soon left the colonial office and British policy in New Zealand changed. Lord Normanby became the Home Secretary and then was the British ambassador in Paris, then minister in Florence. So that's Lord Normanby. Let's return to Catherine Mulgrave again. Well, she trained as a teacher and taught at Moravian Missionary School in Jamaica. In 1842, a team from the Basel Mission visited Jamaica to recruit missionaries for the Danish Gold Coast, now Ghana, in Africa. The leaders of the Basel Mission Society thought that black missionaries, even from a different continent, may be better able to reach black people in Africa. Catherine was recruited as a missionary while still in Jamaica. And there she also married one of the missionaries, George Peter Thompson, even though it was against the wishes of her adopted mother, Lady Normanby. After all, at that time, Catherine Mulgrave was only 16 years old. George Thompson was a black orphan from Liberia. He was taken to Europe by a missionary and educated at a school for poor and orphaned children, led by Christian Heinrich Zeller. Well, here's the first connection. Christian Heinrich Zeller is also my ancestor. So it is a connection, but not necessarily a good one, because George Thompson had been a rising star among the evangelicals in Germany and Switzerland, especially in the Basel Mission. And so the family went to the Danish Gold Coast, where two children were born. However, on the Danish Gold Coast, George Thompson had affairs with several local women and girls. He also was a heavy drinker. He was disciplined by the Basel Mission several times, and Catherine defended him, but finally he was dismissed in 1849. The Basel Mission found his wife, Catherine, more trustworthy, and she stayed on at the mission as a teacher. Catherine and George Thompson also divorced in 1849. Catherine then set up a school for girls on the Danish Gold Coast, and at that time things changed there because the Gold Coast was sold to Britain. The Basel mission suggested that Catherine Mulgrave marry one of the bachelor missionaries in Ghana. And she did that. She married Johannes Zimmermann in 1851. But they did it a bit too early, because according to the rules, a missionary had to be in the field for 5 years before marrying. Johannes Zimmermann had not been in the field for that long, and he had not consulted the main committee of the Basel mission to seek an exemption. His punishment was the denial of furlough for several years. The marriage, however, was a happy one. They had 6 children. Catherine and Johannes Zimmermann were important in formalizing the Ga language, the main language around Accra, the capital of Ghana. Johannes Zimmermann was the main linguist and Bible translator, and they're still well remembered in that country today. Catherine set up more schools and women's prayer meetings. She did go to Germany with her husband in 1873 and 1876 due to his illness. He died in 1876 in Basel, Switzerland. Catherine returned to Africa the following year, where she continued working for the Basel mission. Catherine Zimmermann Mulgrave died on 14th January 1891. And here's another connection. From 1885 to her death, the director of the Basel mission was a certain Theodor Friedrich Oehler, another of my ancestors. He probably never saw her, but they knew of each other, and there were people who were known to both. None of my ancestors ever went into the mission field. Most of them stayed in the German-Swiss border region. But Theodor Oehler, the director of the Basel mission, visited India and China in 1890, traveling to the mission outposts there. And so that way, I also bring in the fifth continent, Asia, into my story. So there are many more aspects of the story of these people, and I could add lists of people and achievements with which they were involved. I hope I painted a picture of the evangelical revival around the world in the 19th century. This cut across denominations, nationalities, races, and class. There were many faithful individuals, many faithful families that worked in mission, government, church, farms, and trade. They worked tirelessly to proclaim and live the gospel of Jesus Christ. This movement of God shaped countries across the world to this day, and I would say for the better. Many of their dreams and visions did not come to fruition in the way they had hoped. But in many ways, they have left a lasting legacy of life and goodness of faith. Today, there is some criticism of the missionaries. Our fellow Anglicans and Tikanga Maori particularly have to endure it at times, as some forces among Maori want to shed all Christian influences. However, that criticism of the missionaries and other faithful Christians who were involved in colonial matters is often based more on ideological grounds and self-interest. I think rather than being ashamed of the missionaries, we can be inspired by them. Yes, the missionaries and the Christian circles from which they came had faults. They intermingled in a greedy, sinful society. They relied on and mixed with questionable characters and schemes in both the European and native cultures they were part of. And they were influenced by common attitudes, some of which we see as questionable in our own time and place. But they were faithful, even in the place of ridicule. They did good works in dark places. They brought peace and justice. They thought of practical solutions in the face of overwhelming tensions. Here was a network of faithful people who had not their own interests, but the good of all people and the coming of God's kingdom at heart. As I look back on this history, I sometimes wonder how much New Zealand has to thank the life of a little girl who was kidnapped from Angola and shipwrecked on the coast of Jamaica.